As evidenced by the Black Lives Matter protest at a Netroots event for Democratic candidates a few days ago, tensions between police departments around the country and Americans of color are higher than they have been in decades. Although current controversies tend to focus on how the police interact with these communities, the other half of the story is the composition of the police forces themselves. The beginning of that history is in 1911, when the NYPD accepted into its ranks the first African-American police officer. In his book, One Righteous Man, Samuel Battle and the Shattering of the Color Line in New York, Arthur Brown, a longtime reporter and editor at the Daily News, tells the forgotten story of the man who had one of the toughest jobs in New York City for over 40 years. It's published by Beacon Press. Arthur, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Samuel Battle's career is an extraordinary story and full of enormous accomplishment. Why has it been so largely forgotten?
I think it was largely forgotten because he left public life around 1950. There was no acknowledgement generally in the public how much he had done. People knew that he happened to have been a black man who had succeeded fantastically in the police department and as a New York City parole commissioner. But there was really no understanding how far he had come. And his attempts to tell his story came to naught.
Then there's the whole problem, the ambivalence of the African-American community toward police. Isn't there? Would some people have seen him as a sellout or a traitor?
Right. He was viewed during his career as both a great path-breaking civil rights pioneer by many in the black community, as a hero, as somebody who had done something that no one ever did, as somebody who was incredibly courageous and leading the way. Yet at times, because of events and because tensions were perpetual between the black community and the NYPD, there were times during his career when he was viewed as on the other side, if you will.
Despite the fact that if you look over at the whole career, he obviously was a very strong advocate for civil rights.
Correct.
Even a pioneer.
An absolute pioneer. He believed, as Eleanor Roosevelt, who became a good friend of his toward the end of his political career, he believed that he was carrying the race on his shoulders. He was willing to weather the criticisms that came with being associated with the NYPD.
He was the son of slaves, one of the first generation of African Americans in the South to be born free. How did that affect his overall outlook about life?
Well, I think that Samuel Battle, as a member, as you said, of the first post-slavery generation, was born and grew up as a boy, not as a, in quotes, boy. He had no sense, I think, of the limitations that had been placed on his parents or on people in the past. And he was also born with this innate sense that he would be treated with dignity in all respects. Even as a young teenager, he felt that, and he lived that.
Growing up in the South?
Or growing up in the South.
Came to New York?
No, growing up in the South, he was part of an enormous family. But he was willing to stand up to the white power structure in New Bern, North Carolina. There was one episode in which he went so far as to strike a white boy who had called him the N-word, which led to his being summoned to that prominent family's house with his father, who was a stern African-American minister, and the white man, who happened to be a judge, insisting that Samuel Battle, young Samuel Battle, maybe he's 13 years old, undergo a whipping. Sam Battle refused. He said to his father, "I will not let this white man whip me, but if you, father, want to whip me, go ahead." And his father did whip him. And at the end of this episode, he said, "I would have done anything in the world not to cry." And he did not cry because he refused to show weakness.
But he came to New York at a time when Harlem was becoming pretty much an African-American community through the equivalent of redlining?
Well, he came to New York shortly after the turn of the 20th century. And when he moved to Harlem around 1905 or 1906, Harlem was still a white upscale community. He was one of the founding citizens of Black Harlem. And there was enormous resistance to the presence even of a few African Americans there.
How were New Yorkers of color treated by the police at that time?
Well, if you look back in history, 1900, 1906, 1902, there were very severe white police riots against Black citizens. There was one notorious in 1900 where the police force just took out their clubs and went wild.
This is in New York.
This is in New York. At times, and as recounted in the book, Blacks were summoned or hauled into station houses, one that was on the West 68th Street, which was then a largely Black area, and subjected to beatings in what the police called the gauntlet.
So why would someone as intelligent as this man want to become a member of the police force?
Well, he was working then as a red cap at Grand Central Depot, which it was called at the time, and he was making a good living. But he also got married. He also had a son, and he looked to the future, and he said, there really is no future for him in red capping. But he saw that there were police, and they were making money, and they had a pension, and he decided to go for it.
And what was the status of efforts to integrate police forces at the turn of the century?
After the
NAACP, which he was a member of, actually was encouraging it.
Yes. After the turn of the century, Black activists and Black ministers in New York City begin advocating for anyone, any young Black man, to step forward to take the test for the New York City Police Department. Didn't happen. When Battle decided to do it, it was at the time that the NAACP was just coming into formation, and he did become a life member of the NYPD, the NAACP, very early.
Now, he was the first Black police officer after New York's consolidation in 1898, but there had been Black police officers in Brooklyn.
Yes. In the early 1890s, a group of Black activists gathered a number of young Black men to try to integrate what was then the Brooklyn Police Force. And they did get onto the force a number of young Black men. But the Brooklyn Police Force turned against them, harassed them, hassled them, disciplined them, drove them out of the police department, except for one man who hung on. His name was Moses P. Cobb. But even then, they required any Black who was associated with the police department to serve as what they called a doorman. And the doorman was essentially the janitor of the station house. They would not allow officers to go out on patrol or to be seen in a police uniform. So the color line really was not, they broke it for a little while. They lasted for a couple of years, but then it all dissipated.
We just found out recently that a dramatized version of Samuel Battle's application to the police force was recorded on WNYC in 1943. There's a photo of him shaking Mayor LaGuardia's hand in our studios on the book jacket. But you want to listen to a little
clip? I would.
Clip?
This is a terrific surprise to me, Leonard, and I would really love to hear it. And the circumstance, I believe, is when Battle is being promoted, I believe.
No, it's when he's been given his physical.
No, I know, but when the 1943 Battle is being promoted from police lieutenant to first Black member of the New York City Parole Commission.
He obviously, we'll talk about him being okay on the Parole Commission, replacing Lou Gehrig after.
That's correct.
We listened to this clip.
Here, let me put the stethoscope to your chest. Nope. Sorry, Battle, but you won't do.
You mean there's something wrong with my heart?
Oh, it's nothing serious.
I can understand it.
Just a slight murmur, that's all. Anyone might have it.
Well, then...
No use, Battle. A man must be in the finest physical condition to be a policeman. While your heart will never give you any trouble in civilian life, you wouldn't do for the police force.
I see.
Oh, You can always get a job with that big body of yours. Try the docks or driving a truck. But the police force does not want you.
But actually, he wound up on the force.
He did wind up on the force, and that was the pretense that the police surgeon attempted to use to prevent him from getting on the police force.
The show seems to suggest that his personal valor won over white officers. Was that a self-serving impression?
No, I don't think so. I think he set out to be the best possible cop that he could be, and he did outwork them in every way possible. And when they subjected him to silence and isolation and to taunts, and they forced him to sleep alone in a room that was then called the flag loft at the police station houses. And just a little bit of information. At that time, there were no police cars, so they kept cops on reserve in terms of emergency. But he would use his time alone in the flag loft doing two things: looking at the flag, wondering why, and second, studying, because he told himself, if these men will not talk to me today, they are going to take my orders in the future.
And he did wind up becoming the first black sergeant and lieutenant in the police department. Got those promotions despite the problems that he would have faced.
Despite everything that he was up against.
Now, he also was a cop during Prohibition, a time when there was a lot of corruption on the force.
Correct. And the then commissioner, Richard Enright, happened to have been, I believe, an extremely corrupt man. And he took control of liquor enforcement under a special unit. And he recruited Battle into that unit, I believe, because he needed a black officer to go undercover. And so Battle was there for much of that corruption. And at one point, he stands up to do the right thing as ordered, and Tammany Hall comes and gets him, and he's suffers a great penalty for it.
Jimmy Hines exiled him to a post in Canarsie for interfering with his illegal activities. But also, Battle challenged the powerful gangster Dutch Schultz by helping to rescue a kidnapped rival, the black numbers racketeer Caspar Holstein.
Correct.
To some of that has been fictionalized by Steven Spielberg.
Doctorow wrote about the Dutch Schultz and Billy Bathgate.
Now, even though Holstein was a criminal, isn't it a historical pattern that prominent figures of oppressed groups on both sides of the law sometimes work together?
It was. But Caspar Holstein was a fascinating figure in that he figured out how to create the numbers as a trustworthy and successful business in Harlem. And he made a lot of money. But he was also a remarkable philanthropist. He gave basically away all his money to causes to help African Americans.
You mentioned that he was put on the parole board. Now, that must have been a major breakthrough.
It was a major breakthrough. And that day, the parole commission was an elevated body. And to hold a position was a great honor. And you mentioned Lou Gehrig. When Lou Gehrig left the Yankees in 1939 because of his disease, LaGuardia honored him by making him a member of the parole commission. When Lou Gehrig died, LaGuardia then selected Battle to take Lou Gehrig's spot.
Now, he was a significant figure in the black community at the time, played a prominent supporter of blacks in the U.S. military, the outbreaks of both world wars. But again, he's largely forgotten, despite the fact that he worked on an autobiography with one of the most distinguished writers of his time.
Yes, in 1949, Sam Battle knew what he had done. He knew how far he'd come. So he hired Langston Hughes, the genius poet of the Harlem Renaissance, to write his biography.
And Eleanor Roosevelt wrote the introduction.
Eventually wrote an introduction to it. They spent 3 years working on it. Langston Hughes was long past his prime as the wunderkind poet. He was struggling to make a living. He took Battle's $1,500 fee. He was not particularly interested in doing the job, but he did it. They submitted it to publishers. It wasn't a terrific narrative, but an editor could have worked that into a good book. The larger problem was that no publisher of the time was ready to put out into the market a book focused on a black hero who challenged the prevailing racism of the day, including of the NYPD. So the manuscript was simply put aside for 65 years until I happened to come across it.
And that was the basis, I imagine, for much of the research in this book.
That was the basis, yes. I could not have written this book without Langston Hughes's work.
How long was Battle alone on the force before other black cops came on board?
Well, he got on the force in 1911. The second black officer arrived about 2 years later in 1913. A third came quickly after that. But the numbers increased very slowly, no more than two or three a year for several decades.
And then he also fought to integrate the fire department. And
right.
That's still an issue today. And as the New York Times pointed out in an article just the other day, it's still difficult for perfectly qualified young black applicants to get onto the force.
Correct. He found a young man who was as tough and as intelligent as he was. Wesley Williams was his name, to fight his way onto the fire department. And if anything, Wesley Williams' fight may have even been harder than Battle's fight. Now, the fire department's history of integration was far worse than the NYPD's. And I think the reason for that was that all along they required black firefighters to sleep in the same dormitories as white firefighters.
Arthur Brown is the Daily News editorial page editor. His book, One Righteous Man, Samuel Battle and the Shattering of the Color Line in New York, is published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me, Leonard. I appreciate it.